For WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Kelly Knoyer. Thanks for joining us. Today, we're digging into the past and future of passenger rail in Wilmington and in the entire state of North Carolina. And there's a lot of there. All throughout the north side of downtown Wilmington, there are little markers of the past, a past filled with the sound of metal wheels clattering down the tracks. You can see it in the bridges crossing the former railway on the north side, in the shape of CFCC's Union Station, in the simple fact that there's so much vacant land right around 3rd Street south of the Isabel Holmes Bridge, a legacy of urban renewal tearing down shanties and rail warehouses that once stood there. Steve Unger is the co-founder of Eastern Carolina Rail, an advocacy organization that is pushing for the development of passenger rail in Wilmington.
The Union Station building at Cape Fear Community College is actually on the side of the old station.
Trains used to be a prominent part of downtown Wilmington, and passenger rail a substantial part of the city's economy. But that changed more than 50 years ago.
The last train came out here in 1968, which might as well be the 19th century. Life has changed a lot since that time.
But with change comes more opportunity. Unger hopes the last half century has left people with a hunger for the rails, and that rail will come back to Wilmington. And indeed, the federal government has invested $500,000 into studying a route between Wilmington and Raleigh for passenger rail. It's one of seven passenger routes being studied in the state, including another route that goes to Asheville. And if all goes according to plan, those that make it through the process will be shovel-ready in 5 to 7 years, with passengers riding the rails in 7 to 12. But let's get back to where the rail actually started, right here in downtown Wilmington with the Wilmington-Weldon Line. It connected Wilmington to the town of Weldon, up near the border with Virginia.
And for a period of time, here in Wilmington, we were the world's longest railroad.
That's Holly Saperstein, the director of the Wilmington Railroad Museum.
When they completed it in March of 1840, it was 161.5 miles, which at that time was the world's longest railroad.
That passenger rail company and those that followed it were the heart of Wilmington's economy for decades. Saperstein's museum occupies an old rail warehouse right by the river in downtown Wilmington. The museum boasts a substantial model train layout, including a view of Wilmington from around the 1940s and 50s.
And away it goes.
This train is modeled on the purple and silver passenger cars that were prominent during that era. As it scoots through downtown Wilmington, Holly explains the architecture around the north side.
And the other side, that we have a freight train. There's the roundhouse. Here's the cut we were talking about.
The cut, as in the man-made crevice in the north side with bridges crisscrossing over it. That's where the trains used to come into town, and it's now owned by NCDOT. Someday it might become a park, and it might someday have passenger trains roll through it again.
Do you see that little building there with the doors?
Mm-hmm.
That is in the area the CFCC has really done a beautiful job of creating this park that's part of the cut. And you can peek through the windows. That's probably the oldest rail building in Wilmington, built probably right around the Civil War. It's a carpenter shop. You can look in there and see the old potbelly stove and stuff.
Looking at the Rail Museum's little section of downtown Wilmington, it looks drastically different. But ghosts of the rails still remain on campus. A pedestrian bridge that emulates a metal truss railroad bridge, a brick pattern laid into the cut to echo railroad tracks, and the little building built into the concrete wall of the cut, with barred windows and a door that was once red but is now faded with time. And of course, there's CFCC's Union Station, sitting on the site of the old Wilmington Union Station Rail Hall, which was opened in 1913 and demolished in 1970. The CFCC building has the same curving facade facing the intersection of North Front and Red Cross Streets. With all these architectural homages, it's clear as day that this entire section of the north side was once ruled by rail. Saperstein and I spent a lot of time nerding out about architecture before our interview. The warehouse the museum occupies is a historic marvel in its own right, she says.
This wonderful roof is from 1883. Used to be on the outside, there was slate on the outside that spelled W&W for the Wilmington and Weldon.
The extremely high roof is matched by 12-foot tall doors all along the side of the building, which is mirrored by a twin building across the way that's been converted into an aloft hotel. This warehouse once belonged to the Gaylord department store, Saperstein says.
We have large arched doorways that are about 7 feet, 8 feet wide, and the walls are 16 inches thick. And so there are these giant sliding doors.
The barn doors would stand open all day to let goods pass through and would get closed up at night to protect the warehouse. The space between the hotel and the museum is wider than you would expect for twin buildings, but there's a reason for that.
Eight sets of tracks were between this building and the twin building on the other side.
There were many such warehouses on the north side. In fact, the entire tract of land from 3rd to the river and from the Isabel Homes to downtown was once an industrial area. It was called Tanktown, and it included not just warehouses, but a port, the train tracks, and a bunch of housing that was occupied by working-class Black workers. Local historian David Norris says the city looked quite different even up until the 1960s.
The rail yard, it was vast with a huge number of buildings and covered a very large area. And at that time, I mean, ships had still come up. Ships very commonly came that far upriver and beyond and would load up. So that would have been kind of a part of the busy port. And then downtown, it would have looked a little more like a port.
Those warehouses and that housing were demolished in the 1960s as part of urban renewal. That was a promise by the federal government to tear down derelict buildings and replace them with new ones. In Wilmington, like in many cities, the government failed to follow through on that promise, instead ripping down homes belonging to Black families, never to replace them. Many of those lots remain vacant to this day. These days, many are owned by the city. An earlier public-private partnership called the Gateway Project, which would have included mixed-use buildings, was derailed. But the city still hopes to get revitalization efforts back on track. But let's get back to the train museum, which has a beautiful 110-year-old train engine out front, complete with a bell you can ring. I pull that thing?
And you gotta, you know, give your strength.
Okay. inner child is very happy right now.
Absolutely.
The train is very popular with actual children, not just inner children. And while the model trains are great, as are the little models of towns and cities from all around our great state, the real star of today's show is the historic Wilmington Weldon Railroad, even if this section of its historic line is now a parking lot. The rail helped make Wilmington a destination for its port, for commerce, even for tourism, Saperstein says.
Rail travel was the biggest change in transportation in 5,000 years. Prior to that, it didn't matter where you were in the world. You were either walking, riding an animal, or on a cart pulled by an animal or a person. There was no way to get around quickly.
The railroad changed a 7-day walk to a 5-hour train ride. It completely modernized the region's economy and opened up the region to tourism and business travel that wasn't feasible before.
So you could transport things that would go bad, something like, you know, fruits, vegetables, things like that, that a 7-day trip, they might not hold up. You could even pack things on ice like meat, produce, milk products, and ship them other places.
Local historian David Norris says Wilmington was the end of the line, but passengers and goods could still be transported further south.
So the railroad bought 4 steamships, and they would run to Charleston, and they kept that up for a while. Round trip was 29 and a half hours. The rail connection to the south was ready only in 1854. They finished the Wilmington and Manchester Railroad, and that one that had branches that you could get to railroads that linked with Charleston, so you wouldn't need the steamers to go to Charleston anymore. So it's a lot faster for passengers.
Railroads were a lot more competitive in those days, and they didn't necessarily work well together. A train built for one kind of tracks wouldn't work on another, Saperstein says.
They weren't playing nice together. And so that was a bit of a problem, especially with Southern railroads. The independent nature of the Southern railroads, you know, caused them some problems about expansion. What you did see, though, is the Wilmington and Weldon acquire some of these and merge with them.
That expansion came later, though. In the mid-1800s, railroad companies were often named for the routes they ran, like the Wilmington-Weldon. Still, Norris says passengers on that train often used multiple companies to get where they needed to go, even if some occasionally ended up stuck in Wilmington overnight.
And passengers would have to, they'd have to wait for a ferry across the river, and then you'd catch the Wilmington and Manchester Railroad, and their station was, as I believe, is right about where the battleship is.
That's a train heading to Manchester, South Carolina, inland and south of our coastal city.
And then you could go on, they had tracks going across Eagles Island and then on into Brunswick County.
The Wilmington Weldon was originally built by enslaved people and used to transport cotton. It was also a key supply line for the Confederacy during the Civil War, according to Saperstein.
General Lee called the Wilmington Weldon the lifeline of the South. It was the premier way that they got troops, artillery, food goods, uniforms, everything that was needed to continue the battle.
Sometimes the troops passing through Wilmington got up to trouble, according to Norris.
There's a time during the Civil War the Confederates were sending troops from Virginia to fight in the Battle of Chickamauga, which is in northern Georgia, in September of 1863. And there was the soldiers that said they would get dropped off in Wilmington and had to wait for the ferries.
It was a chaotic time in U.S. history, and it was hard to keep track of the comings and goings. Some took advantage of that fact.
A bunch of Texas soldiers went to Patty's Hollow and started a big saloon fight in a house of ill repute or saloon down in there, and they ended up injuring three of the city policemen and the city watchmen, I think. But anyway, then the Texans, they got back on the train and blended in with the regiment, so they never found out who they were or anything.
Eventually, the Union targeted the railroad to help put an end to the war.
The Union knew this. That to really stop the Confederacy, they were going to have to stop the rail. And we have some amazing pictures of black Union troops who had probably been part of the foundation of this rail. They had probably worked it. Now pulling up rail line of the Wilmington and Weldon and turning it into what they called the Sherman's Knot, which was they would twist it around a fire and just disable the rail lines.
Soon after the Wilmington Weldon line fell, so too did the Confederacy. Enslaved workers who were freed during emancipation went on to become thriving members of the black middle class in Wilmington.
Some of the people were trained as blacksmiths through this process. Later on, after becoming a freed people, started blacksmith shops right here in Wilmington.
And their skills were still needed at the railroad, too.
After the emancipation, the Wilmington and Weldon let their enslaved people go back to their homes or freed them. And said, we'll just hire white people to do this work. And so they hire some people to fill in. And in the next board meeting, you hear them say, these people aren't skilled. They don't know what they're doing. We need to bring back the people who were working for us before. And yeah, we're gonna have to pay them. And so you saw that they brought back their black skilled workers and black labor workers to continue the success of what they had. And through 1898, then those people who came back were part of the growing Wilmington and Weldon, and which became the Atlantic coastline. Mm. I had the opportunity to speak to a woman who is about 100 years old. Her husband was actually one of the first black executives for the Atlantic coastline. His father actually had been an enslaved worker who worked with the Atlantic coastline.
Wow.
So to see that generational change for that family was just striking.
Over time, the railroads consolidated, and Norris says the line from Weldon to Wilmington became part of the Atlantic Coastline Company.
Eventually, the Wilmington and Weldon, it started growing and absorbing other lines, and eventually it became, renamed itself the Atlantic Coastline, and then that merged with Seaboard, and then that merged into CSX in 1986, and that kind of brings us up to today.
CSX still owns the railroads that come to Wilmington for freight. When it was still the Atlantic Coastline, though, it was headquartered in Wilmington. But that changed in 1955 when the company decided to move its headquarters to Jacksonville, Florida. Saperstein says it devastated the city's economy.
There were over 1,200 families in Wilmington that were employed by the Atlantic Coastline. And all the businesses in Wilmington were supported by paychecks from the Atlantic coastline. If you had a mom-and-pop shop, a restaurant, a laundry, you relied on Atlantic coastline employees' pay to continue to keep your business open. So when it was announced that they were going to relocate, it was frightening, it was devastating.
The city's leaders had allowed the railroad to control the city's economy. It was a railroad town through and through. That's according to Wilmington Mayor Bill Saffo.
There was kind of a give and take with the city because the city fathers in those days also wanted to recruit other industries and businesses to this community. The railroad, because of its power, because of the amount of people that it employed, always kind of threatened them not to do that because they were concerned about rising labor costs.
But all that preferential treatment didn't keep the railroad in Wilmington. When it ultimately moved to Jacksonville, Florida in 1960, 900 employees moved with it. The total economic impact took 3,500 jobs out of the port city. That was nearly 10% of the population at the time, and it was devastating. Saffo says one in every four homes was for sale in the city. It was a tough lesson for the city's leadership.
That's when the Committee of 100 was created, which, of course, turned out it would be Wilmington Business Development, which is what it is today, said never again. We would diversify our economy. We would start looking for other companies to locate here in the Wilmington area. Of course, shortly thereafter came DuPont, came GE, came Corning, came W.R. Grace, came Babcock, Wilcox. And they brought in a significant amount of industries that kind of started rebuilding the employment base here in the city of Wilmington and diversifying the economy.
Passenger service itself died with a whimper in Wilmington less than a decade after the headquarters were moved. The last passenger train left Wilmington's Union Station in 1968. The service ended because of a lack of demand.
And it got to the point that they were losing tons of money on passenger service. Wilmington, for example, when they finally stopped the last train, there was probably less than a dozen people riding on that train every day.
Wow.
So it just economically could not continue.
It came down to competition. Trains simply couldn't compete for customers with the convenience and flexibility of personal vehicles or the speed and range of passenger jets. Railroad companies just turned over to freight and left passenger service behind. But the city is still heavily marked by the loss of that passenger rail, as is its economy.
The granddaughter of the Atlantic Coastline is CSX. So Atlantic Coastline, Seaboard, and other rail companies all merged together when they started seeing rail travel change to more really a freight operation. And it became CSX, which is just freight.
CSX still brings freight into Wilmington's port today, and it's the steward of the tracks that may soon again carry passengers to Wilmington. CSX also owns many of the tracks that Amtrak operates on today across the state. All right, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll hop on the train in Selma and learn about how the passenger rail system works in North Carolina today. I'm Kelly Knoyer. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us.
There's an old black train a-coming, scraping along the iron. You don't need no ticket, boys, it'll take you when it's time.
You're listening to The Newsroom from WHQR Public Media. I'm Kelly Knoyer, and today we're on a tour of passenger rail in southeastern North Carolina, starting in Selma, a town that wouldn't exist without the train system and completely identifies as a rail town. It's just after 11:30 a.m. when the northbound Carolinian whistles into the station, ready to take passengers up to Richmond, D.C., and then on to New York. The train is late, but most of the passengers are here for vacation, so they don't seem too bothered.
Well, there's less traffic, less stress. You can sit and read my book or play on the phone, whatever I need to do.
That's Christine Sinerak, who's planning to go up and see her daughter in D.C. Four trains come through the town each day, two each, northbound and southbound, on different routes. The station is designed for it. There are platforms on both sides of the little historic building.
Is it just hearing it gets you excited?
Yeah.
Christine is one of more than 17,000 passengers who board or disembark in Selma each year.
How are you feeling right now?
So excited.
Have a good trip.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Since the pandemic, Amtrak in North Carolina has had a bull run. That's according to Jason Orthner, the rail division director at NCDOT.
We're celebrating this year our 30th year of the Piedmont service and 35th year of the Carolinian service. So we have a deep history in North Carolina of passenger rail service. Ridership is increasing. We're 55% higher than pre-pandemic 2019 levels on ridership. So folks are really riding trains.
Amtrak was created by Congress in 1970 through the Rail Passenger Service Act. It was initially known as the National Railroad Passenger Corporation and rebranded a year later. Probably a good PR move. Amtrak absorbed about three-quarters of the private rail lines still providing intercity routes at the time. It was a big deal, Orthner says.
Prior to that, you know, the railroads operated passenger trains on their own. And honestly, it was passenger rail service that really created the rail system because folks needed to get around. It was the first national transportation system developed in our country.
At the time, it was something of an odd experiment, a quasi-public company operating as a for-profit business, but receiving state and federal subsidies. It's overseen by a board appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. Many honestly expected Amtrak to peter out in the first few years after it was created. Apparently, that included President Richard Nixon, who signed the rail bill into law. But proponents claimed it would eventually become profitable and self-sustaining. Over a half century later, Amtrak has stayed more popular than its doubters imagined, but funding has remained a challenge. Amtrak got more than $2.4 billion in government subsidies in 2024. Even as it set a record that year, with 32 million customers and $2.5 billion in ticket revenue, it's still not profitable, just like all other public transit in the United States. But advocates like Steve Unger from Eastern Carolina Rail say that shouldn't matter.
Well, rail doesn't always pay for itself, and neither do highways necessarily if you do a cost-benefit. It would provide the opportunity for people, one, low-income folks, and serve rural communities such as Wallace and Warsaw and Selma. It would help provide transportation alternatives for those places.
Amtrak's need for subsidy has, at times, put it in the crosshairs. Though the most recent federal budget kept funding flat for the quasi-public company, even as DOGE and the Trump administration made deeper cuts elsewhere. At the state level, there's been support for passenger rail on both sides of the aisle for decades, Orthner says.
Republican Governor Jim Martin was the first governor to initiate really our passenger rail program in its current form. And the service and the support of both the executive branch and the legislative branch has been there for throughout that entire period. It's been a bipartisan support.
Passenger rail has broad public appeal, too. While it dropped in popularity in the middle of the last century, things have changed. The personal vehicle is no longer a shiny, new, appealing mode of transportation, and traffic has made it less fun to drive, as population growth has put more people behind the wheel in NC. The U.S. population has nearly doubled since 1960. 1 in 10 Americans rarely or never drive a car, and that rate rises to 2 in 10 for Americans living in urban areas. Passenger rail makes the next town over more accessible to these Americans, who, by choice or by ability, do not drive. I wanted to try it for myself, so I decided to hop on board the Palmetto, the northbound train from Selma to Wilson, with photographer Maddie Gray. As I waited on the platform, antsy with anticipation, I chatted up a fellow writer, Peggy Johnson, who lives 20 minutes from Selma.
I've been taking the train for a long time.
I told her a bit about the potential lines being considered in North Carolina.
Tell me a little bit about what trips you would want to take when that's available. And they might also connect to Asheville, so we're looking at that.
Oh, that would be good.
And a speed line up to D.C.
How long would it take you to D.C.?
I think it'd be about an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
It'd be screaming fast, yeah.
That would be so wonderful, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I think it would be out of Raleigh.
Yeah,
straight up there, yeah.
I think that'd be great.
This little station is cute. The pillars on the outside are designed to look like railroad trestles and hold up the roof to protect passengers from the rain while they wait. Everyone lines up where the cars will stop for them, in coach or in business class. The uniformed Amtrak employees lean out of the train as it slows to a halt, then hop down onto the platform to check tickets and occasionally help passengers with bags.
What, last night, please?
Kenoyer?
Yeah.
And Gray.
Yeah,
that's me. Thank you.
We board the train and find a couple seats, then settle in for a couple minutes as the train starts up again before getting up to explore.
Oh, we could go in the dining car. Let's do that.
The ride is surprisingly gentle and smooth. In the dining car, we meet Linton Williams, who says he's a regular on this line.
I'm from Washington, D.C.
Oh, really? Okay. Uh-huh. And where are you coming up from?
I'm coming from Selma, North Carolina.
Were you there for a visit?
I take care of my dad, so I'm here. I travel every 2 weeks pretty much on the train between the two.
So it's a little bit of a commute for you?
Yes. My dad is 94 to 95 in November.
Wow.
So he's been a good dad, so I'm his caregiver, so I'm back and forth all the time on the train now. Because of my vision, I'm now on the train all the time instead of driving.
Glaucoma has taken Linton's vision, but he was riding the train a lot even before that.
Before my vision left, I do a lot of things. I'm retired, but I still have a little business on the side. So I get a lot of things accomplished, I get a lot of reading done. I just finished a program that I had to study for, and luckily on the train I can get hours worth of studying done, you know, without being distracted. So.
He says it's well worth it for the price, especially since he has a senior discount. He can get a ticket and coach from Selma to D.C. for as little as $40. And man, does he love the dining car.
I've got a veggie burger and what else do I have? A veggie burger and some ginger ale and I think that's an orange juice. That's what I have. Yeah, pretty standard for
some
me.
Some fruit.
And a fruit cup. I forgot. I did get the fruit cup. Yeah, I love the fruit cup. Yeah, fruit cup is really fresh. It's amazing. I got it one day when they were out of everything else that I wanted and thought, okay, I'm going to be disappointed. I know it now. I was amazed at how good it was.
He's also excited about the proposed S-Line, a high-speed route currently in planning stages. It would be a high-speed passenger line from Richmond to Raleigh with speeds up to 110 miles per hour. That would save an hour of travel time between the two cities, making the trip from Washington, D.C. competitive with driving times, according to NCDOT. Taking the train is more economical over short distances than longer rides. Riding from Raleigh to Washington, D.C. would be just under $50 and take 5 to 6 hours, while a one-way Delta flight on that route costs $89 and takes over an hour. But it's not always reliable, at least if you have to be anywhere at a specific time. A quarter of Amtrak's trips operated with some kind of delay last year. That's compared to about a fifth of flights getting delayed. For trains, the cause is almost always the companies that own the rails Amtrak uses. Freight often takes priority, causing lengthy delays. The train back to Selma was a bit delayed, giving me an opportunity to admire the town of Wilson's much larger train station and see the town's famous whirligigs. But once we got on board for our return trip, we met Monica Ray, who was heading down from D.C. to Fayetteville.
Interesting story. My mom had a double mastectomy in August. So I've been back and forth between D.C. and here, making sure she was okay, and I'm going to pick her up. But I had to work today. I'm short of time. So I thought the train would be cool to ride down, have a car to come back. So that's what I'm doing. So I've worked all day, and I'll be in North Carolina a couple hours.
Very nice.
She runs a nonprofit and used her time on the train to take a Zoom call, prepare a budget, and check her emails.
It's been easier and more peaceful here than it would have been in my office.
Wow.
She normally drives or flies, but was happy with her choice to take the train this time.
I would prefer to fly, but by the time I spend an hour in the airport in D.C., an hour in the air, and an hour driving home, I could be home by driving. So typically I drive. It's about 5 hours. So I literally will have spent about 6.5 hours to get home rather than drive. So it's really not a bad option. It's a really good option, quite frankly. And I walked into the train station in Union Station at like 9:48. And got on the train at 9:59, so.
Of course, it did take longer than a drive would have, but it was productive time, with free Wi-Fi, and she got to take a nap. We head back to our seats and watch the countryside pass by. Sections of farms and farmland you can't ever see from the highway. We got off the train again in Selma, a place that has really made a meal out of its identity as a railroad town. Mayor Byron McAllister says the town only came into existence because a railroad stop was put in here. There's a common joke in the town's government.
The way the rail folks see it is the good Lord made it all in 7 days. Then the rail came, and then everything else is behind it. But yes, most of these towns, they propagated from the rail.
And every bit of Selma celebrates that railroad connection. There are train engines on the town seal and the town flag. There's an old railroad station and a new one that's still in use. There's art all over town depicting the train and businesses with cutesy railroad-themed names like Trackside Antiques or Coffee on Rayford with its railroad track logo. And you can watch a live stream of the town's Diamond Crossing, a relatively rare kind of track crossing in the U.S., on the town's official website. Hey, you know how every small town has a themed festival? Take a wild guess what that looks like in Selma.
So Railroad Days, of course, is our big festival, the first full weekend in October every single year for the last 50 years. We celebrate the rail. This year, we're going to call it 7 days of Railroad Days.
Those train spotters who adore the models at the Railroad Museum in Wilmington will be thrilled with Selma's little festival, where model train clubs take up residence in the Civic Center.
Particularly last year was an absolute surprise. I think we had approximately 13,000 people come through for the weekend, which is pretty huge for a town of 7,000 people. We expect even more this year for the 50th.
McAllister is excited for more about the future than just his town's festival, though. Selma might end up on a proposed route from Wilmington to Raleigh, creating an east-west rail connection that hasn't existed for passenger rail in modern history. He feels confident that the town will prosper with a connection like that. It would make Selma a transfer point, giving visitors a reason to linger downtown and pop into the shops that have been cropping up there.
Our downtown is coming back to life as of recently. So folks that have been traveling back and forth on the train, folks that have even been visiting Selma regularly, are just now realizing there are shops back open in Selma, North Carolina.
He and other mayors all along the route see passenger rail as a real chance at economic development. Plus, improvements to freight might come along, which will benefit the city. And there's another town that's lost its connection to the railroad, just like Wilmington, that would love to get it back.
There's really legitimate cultural reasons that passenger rail has benefits.
We'll hear more from the mayor of Goldsboro and more about the future of rail in our state when we come back from this break. I'm Kelly Knoyer. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. You're listening to The Newsroom. I'm Kelly Knoyer, local rail buff and local reporter. I'm inside the old railroad station in Goldsboro. There's a storm outside, and the rain and thunder create an ominous mood. The ceilings are high, the aging plaster flaking off the walls, and the place is dimly lit by lamps strung to the ceiling. I ask the mayor, Charles Gaylor IV, to show me around.
By the way, can you show me the upstairs? Okay, good to know.
So, Aaron, are you thinking just walk straight up the catwalk and go around, or how far?
No, I would take the steps.
I'll go ahead of you. Okay.
That's city staffer Aaron Fonesca.
Wet spots where there's missing.
And this is that old style of plaster with the boards directly behind it.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. Oh my goodness.
There's scaffolding that's been added to the building from when it was used as a timber sale shop decades ago. Upstairs, water damage has made the floor unstable. This storm has water dripping through the roof, but gosh, it's gorgeous.
Look at this ceiling.
The place has that smell you get in old libraries of ancient timber and air that hasn't moved in a long, long time.
Wow. Oh my gosh, look at that door. This is so cool.
This Mission Eclectic-style building opened to passengers in 1909, says Johnny Peacock, a member of the town's railroad task force.
You step outside and you see those Mission features with three bays in here. And there were, because of the times, there was an African-American section, waiting room, toilet facilities, and then you had a white section. They all came in, they all went out different doors. They all got on the same train, though. That's just one of the things that, you know, the story that must be told. It's an unfortunate thing, but it's part of the history of the building.
You can almost feel the ghosts of the passengers in the old waiting room, which has two separate waiting areas for segregation in a typical post-Reconstruction fashion. The vaulted ceiling with dental molding, the columns set into the wall, the 15-foot-high transom doors. Some of the original 15-inch deep molding still remains and can be replicated, Peacock says.
It was a very grand building in its day, not only from an exterior standpoint, very imposing, but then once you walked in, you saw the care and the detail that went into this. And it was a very memorable building. When you came through here, this was unlike any other railroad station that you would see for many miles around.
Saving this station is a priority for folks in Goldsboro. It's a historic monument that speaks to the city's history as a railroad town. And folks in Goldsboro see a rail connection to their city as a way to help make that happen. Erin Fonseca is the downtown development director for Goldsboro. She says advocates with Saving Union Station are working closely with Eastern Carolina Rail.
So most recently, we have started an effort to advocate for passenger rail with the creation of Saving Union Station, which is a subcommittee of the DGDC. That is a collection of passionate individuals that care a lot about the history of the station that we're standing in and then the potential for future rail, not only passenger but freight, to connect Raleigh to Wilmington.
These advocates are the voices of Goldsboro, but they're not alone. According to Steve Unger with Eastern Carolina Rail, mayors and council members all along the route are pushing for the passenger rail project to come to fruition. And that's the case along every route proposed in North Carolina. As we noted at the top of the show, there are seven of them, and they all got initial funding from the federal government in 2023. They are Charlotte to Kings Mountain, Charlotte to Washington, D.C., Fayetteville to Raleigh, Asheville to Salisbury, Wilmington to Raleigh, Winston-Salem to Raleigh, and Charlotte to Atlanta. That last route is complicated, according to Jason Orthner, the director of NCDOT's rail division. But that doesn't mean it's a lower priority than any of the others.
Now, some are going to be more complicated than others. Certainly, working across state lines like the Charlotte to Atlanta route required a significant amount of coordination across state lines. So that's a consideration. But for the intrastate corridors, where we are working with the railroads and working with the communities, we expect those to proceed at pace. But officially, no, there's not a priority on any of these corridors.
Still, there's not enough funding to go around. Each of these initial grants just funded a feasibility study. Those grants each cost $500,000. And it's the first step in a three-step process. Step one's feasibility studies gave us cost estimates. The Wilmington to Raleigh route would cost $810 million, while Asheville to Salisbury is estimated to cost $665 million. Step two will be an implementation and service plan, Orthner says, and local communities can make a difference there because the federal government will only fund 90% of that step.
There is a non-federal match. That's the major component that's needed to continue to advance these projects.
He says it's unlikely that every North Carolina route will move forward, given available funding at the federal level. But he's hopeful that a lot of the state's proposed routes are competitive. Step three requires a 20% local match and would give the selected routes engineering and environmental assessments. That would mean the project is shovel-ready and can be built. There are a total of 69 routes being studied under this corridor identification program across the U.S., including the seven in North Carolina. If they do get built, it'll be 7 to 12 years before passengers can board a train in Wilmington and get to Raleigh. But just imagine it. Imagine a world where all those routes exist. I asked a ton of people what they would do if they had that opportunity.
The other night where I kind of bumped off a flight, I would have loved to have the opportunity to maybe have an opportunity to get on a train to come back to Wilmington if I could have.
I would love to get on a train and go to New York City, get off in Penn Station and just roll my bag down in the street to the hotel. That would be ideal. I'd like to take a train out west and then switch over to one of those incredible trains that rolls through the Rocky Mountains of Colorado or along the coastline highway in California. That would be wonderful to take a train.
So I would say from Goldsboro to New York through DC, you know, how cool would that be to get on a train in Goldsboro, North Carolina, and get off in New York City? I mean, that would be amazing.
I think it would be good for Wilmington. It'd be very convenient to be able to, if we could take a train, go to Raleigh, visit a museum and come back, it would be. And I think a lot of folks would like to come down here to visit. And it's like the downtown, it's fairly compact and walkable. If you got dropped off by a train, it'd be a nice place to stay. And there's plenty to do here and enjoy. And so I think it would be a good idea if we could get everything together and make it work.
For me, it's all about the dream trip. Jumping on a train right in downtown Wilmington, taking it to Raleigh, then transferring to a train to head out to Asheville and enjoy the mountains. I'd bring my bicycle as one of my free carry-ons and use it to scoot around the city and enjoy some trails. All right, that's enough dreaming. Besides, this is at least 7 years away, more likely 12. And there's some logistics involved here, so let's get into the nitty-gritty. First, there's the tracks. For a lot of the planned route, CSX already operates trains on existing rails. And Steve Unger says laying new tracks where they don't already exist won't be too hard.
We do know that we have the rail corridor. In fact, the DOT owns the corridor through Pender County, where the tracks were once pulled up. So actually laying down tracks is one of the easier things that they can do.
In New Hanover County, the DOT owns the cut as well. The train could come all the way into downtown and load passengers at Paget Station, which was built as the first phase of a multimodal transit center, with this vision of a return to passenger rail in mind. Wilmington Mayor Bill Saffo says plans to put a park in that area can still accommodate passenger trains.
We have been working with CSX, with the North Carolina Department of Transportation, in being able to create a trail system in that gulch and at the same time protecting the right-of-way, you know, in and out of Wilmington in regards to rail. So the rail, the right-of-way is there. The property is there.
The feasibility study is out now, and it looks like the route would have 3 round trips per day. Based on current estimates, tickets would run about $30 in 2024. It would take 2 hours and 35 minutes to get from Wilmington to Raleigh, and building that route would cost, as we mentioned, $810 million. Here's Unger again.
And before you gasp at that figure, that's the same figure it's going to take to build 10 miles of freeway between North Myrtle Beach and Charlotte in North Carolina to finish that missing link. So highways are very expensive. Rail, by comparison, is not nearly as expensive.
Why is it cheaper to build rail than highway? Well, the land that doesn't already have tracks on it is owned by the state. That means there's no costly land acquisition process, unlike with most highways. And most of the route between Goldsboro and Raleigh will be on freight lines owned by the North Carolina Railroad Company. New rail will need to be built to create a connection to the Goldsboro Rail Station and connect up to CSX tracks that go to Wilmington. The state owns land between Wallace and Castle Hayne, where the tracks will need to be restored. In the end, the route will include stops in Wilmington, Goldsboro, Selma, Clayton, Raleigh, and 2 additional stops that'll get figured out later. I hear Burgaw wants in. There was a western route that was also under consideration that would run through Fayetteville and take an hour longer. The eastern route through Goldsboro is the one that got the feasibility report's recommendation, though. It creates a redundant rail route, which would be helpful in case of emergencies. And that's a relief to folks in Goldsboro, like Mayor Charles Gaylor IV.
It's taken decades of consistent pressure from the community. You know, this is not the kind of thing that, you know, an election happens and a new politician's in office and all of a sudden off you go. Everything is built on those that have come before you, trying to put things in process and trying to build relationships and make things happen.
These federal grants appear to be safe from federal cuts. They made it through the DOGE cuts and the Big Beautiful Bill, likely because passenger rail has some strong bipartisan support. But the next steps will require that 10% and 20% local match, respectively, according to NCDOT's Jason Orthner.
Obviously, it's up to the Congress to continue to fund that program. There is a non-federal match. That's the major component that's needed to continue to advance these projects. And so that's a part of the conversation we're having. You know, as long as we can find and identify those non-federal match funds at the 10% level for this next step, then we're able to continue to advance these projects.
It's possible that the state legislature will chip in to fund these matches, though NCDOT itself is chronically underfunded. But it may be that local governments along each of these routes will need to chip in to help bring together those matching funds. This passenger line to Wilmington has been in the works for decades. First studied in the late 1990s, it's just been put on the back burner again and again. But Gaylor thinks it's time. He expects that the legislature will be willing to back the funding needs for this route.
Everyone wants to see good things happen in their district.
And his fellow mayor at the other end of the line, Bill Saffo, agrees, even if it might take a while.
I think there's a lot more bipartisan energy, and I think that the elected leaders in all these communities want to do what's best for their community also and improve their communities, and this is a good way to do that. I think our local delegation here would be supportive of it. It all depends on what it looks like, what it's going to cost, and how those costs are paid. But I do think that there's support from with our local delegation to do something to get rail back into the city of Wilmington.
For this city and for Goldsboro, it's the return of a mode of transit that has a great meaning in each city's history. For Wilmington in particular, after the devastation of the Atlantic Railroad pulling out in the 1960s, it would be healing to have the trains return downtown. Orthner sees nothing but positives.
You know, the rail system has certainly seen a decline in Wilmington, you know, through the various changes in economic forces and the commercial arrangements, you know, for various types of movements of goods. But the investment in rail at this point, I think, will certainly continue to drive the economic development of not just the Wilmington region, but also the state as a whole.
At each end of this line, there will be a nod to history. Goldsboro taking the chance to repair and revitalize its beautiful, decrepit station, and Wilmington placing a new Union Station paces away from the old.
Well, the great news is that Wilmington can build its station here in downtown Wilmington, close to where the old Union Station was. It would be right there at between 3rd and 4th Street.
It feels like it's a long way off, but if the route makes it through the next two phases, we'll have that shovel-ready plan to start construction. And with luck, that will lead to these corridors actually being built. Mayor Sappho has an idea of what might happen once we get there.
There'll be a final process that will evaluate all of these things. And I think, from my perspective, the legislature is willing to go through that process to see what is it going to look like? What is it going to cost? How many passengers are we expecting? How much of the traffic can we divert off of our roads, which is another big point of contention. I mean, as the third fastest growing state in the country, and with the amount of people that are moving into our areas, the demand for more and more roads and improvements to those roads continues to increase. How can we move people around and give them better options and more options than we currently have today? I think that all ties into this whole scoping process.
Administrations come and go, parties come in and out of power in Raleigh, but this project, it has legs, at least according to community leaders who've been fighting for it for years. And they think getting passenger rail into Wilmington, it's just a matter of time. I can nearly hear the trains whistle downtown again. Or maybe that's just the bell at the Railroad Museum. Past and future coming together again on the north side. That's about all the time we have left for the newsroom. Thanks for listening. This story was originally reported for the Assembly, and you can read that article and see terrific photos from Maddie Gray on their website. Thank you to the many sources who made this story possible. Jason Orthner, Jean Merritt and Steve Unger, Holly Saperstein, David Norris, and the many lovely train passengers who chatted with me, along with Mayors Byron McAllister, Bill Sappho, and Charles Gaylor IV. Thanks also to other members of the Goldsboro community, past and present, who spoke with me and advocated for their station and the railroad. Johnny Peacock, Aaron Fonseca, Julie Metz, and Doug McGrath. I also spoke with the Goldsboro mayor's father, Charlie Gaylor Sr., for this story, and he unfortunately passed away before publication. He was an advocate for the station and the railroad and one of the city's unofficial historians. Here he is talking about the importance of his city in the 1800s.
And one of the reasons Goldsboro was named one of the nine cities in the state that was of a very important nature for business and for rail and whatever. And that was because of our connections with the railroad and the freight. And of course, it was also a big objective of the Civil War, during the Civil War, that they were able to get into Goldsboro because they wanted that line.
Gaylor Sr. is much missed by his family and his community, and it was an honor to speak with him before his passing. The WHQR production team is News Director Ben Shockman and Program Director Ken Campbell. If you have questions about today's programming or ideas for a future show, you can email us at newsroom@whqr.org. If you missed any part of this show, you can find it at whqr.org or get the show as a podcast pretty much anywhere you can get podcasts. I'm Kelly Knoyer. Thanks again for listening to The Newsroom from WHQR Public Media.